Would you mind saying a little bit about the pieces? She asked very innocently. Sure, I could do that. Well, do you think you could tell us all why you said you love this Haydn piece? Did I say that? Knowing full well not to question the wife of a former attorney, who then pointed calmly to the email I had sent a few weeks before. Well, I guess I can do that, because I really do love this piece. It represents all that's positive in life. Great, then you can make it a from the heart piece. Busted. But I really did want to tell you all something about the Haydn we're going to perform this morning, because I really do love this piece for a lot of different reasons. But first, a little bit about St. Cecilia, the patron saint of music and musicians. According to legend, Cecilia, who lived in the 4th century, was a young Christian of high rank, betrothed to a Roman named Valerian. Through her influence, Valerian was converted to Christianity and was martyred along with his brother. Accused of converting over 400 people to Christianity, Cecilia was sentenced to death. After surviving an attempted suffocation in a bathhouse, pious tradition recounts that after being struck 3 times on the neck with a sword, Cecilia lived for 3 more days. Her musical fame rests on a passing note in her legend that she praised God as she lay dying a martyr's death. Each year around November 22nd, which is St. Cecilia's name day, I feel compelled to thank the muses who have allowed music to be created and charged me with reproducing it. And I attempt to encourage this mighty church choir and this generous chamber orchestra to join in my campaign. I hope, too, that you as a congregation can also joyously partake of this event in whatever capacity you choose. And today there's a big capacity for you. You'll find out later. A little bit about the Te Deum. Haydn wrote this work, the second of his 2 Te Deums, in Eisenstadt, Austria, a town very near the Hungarian border where my family and I have spent the last 9 summers. Jamie, the other one, spends his days working in the castle where Haydn's Esterházy patrons, Fürst Anton and later Fürst Nikolaus II, lived. We absorb all the marvels of this charming little city, which is about the same size as Williamsburg, eating at the places Haydn ate, listening to music in the Haydnsaal, which is one of the world's most acoustically and visually stunning concert halls, scooting up to Vienna to the Oper or Musikverein, drinking wine in the local Heurigen, and continually being overwhelmed by the hectares of vineyards on the gentle slopes of the Leita Mountains and abundant sunflowers that dominate the Burgenland countryside. And Burgenland is das Land der Sonne, the sunshine state. Is any of this important information? Well, in my opinion, this Te Deum setting takes on the characteristics of much of what I have described above, most especially the part about the sunflowers and the wine. The locals, for whom Haydn is a near demigod, swear that you can hear the wine in Haydn's music. And for the record, it's red. And what of the text? The Te Deum is sometimes called the Ambrosian hymn because of its association with St. Ambrose. It is an early text that has held a place in Catholic worship since the 6th century. Settings of the Te Deum are traditionally festive, often including both trumpets and timpani, and were sung to celebrate either a musical victory or the signing of a peace treaty. Now, physical space and acoustics have precluded the inclusion of the timpani in today's performance. Although the piece was written for the Empress Maria Theresa, who was the wife of Franz I, the grandson of the Empress Maria Theresia, the first recorded performance of Haydn's Te Deum took place in Eisenstadt on September 8, 1800, and it was directed by Haydn. The performance was part of a large, elaborate annual celebration to honor Prince Nikolaus' wife, Maria Hermenegild von zu Liechtenstein. The Liechtensteins were the most prominent aristocratic family in the Habsburg Empire, outranking the Esterházys. In attendance at these celebrations in 1800 were Lord and Lady Hamilton and the British naval hero, Admiral Lord Horatio Nelson. Lord Nelson's recent victory over Napoleon at Aboukir was of great significance to the Austrians and the Hungarians, as it marked a turning point in the Napoleonic Wars. It's thought that Haydn's Te Deum was sung to celebrate this victory. One of the things I enjoy most about this work is Haydn's cleverness and sense of humor, which are apparent to me in the setting. He uses the plain song tune from the 8th psalm tone, Te Deum laudamus, as the opening melody of the work. There are no solo passages, although he uses some reduced choral textures to imply solo passages. And the best stuff comes right after the double fugue at the text, Non confundar in aeternum. And you have a translation on your purple sheet there. This translates as, Let me never be confounded. Here, Haydn drags the basses abruptly from a cadence in D minor to a tritone skip, dropping a minor seventh, these are very awkward intervals, outlining the words confused or confounded on a syncopated rhythm. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, don't worry, you'll recognize the part when we get there, trust me, it'll work out. The chorus answers twice, and then the basses skip another minor seventh, taking the group away again from their comfort. After two more responses, the orchestra seizes the moment to distract the choir and moves them yet again away from where they were in the same manner as the basses. Just as the chorus tries to get it all together, Haydn sets first the sopranos off by an eighth note and then followed by the tenors and basses, still playing into the confusion of this supposed non-confusion, non-confounded state. His parting shot is on the words, in aeternum, in eternity, where the choir holds their pitches twice as long as one might expect. He does that in the creation too. But why does this make me so happy? And again, is it really important? Well, I could get into a lot of stuff that my husband has been reading to me from Oliver Sacks' new book called Musicophilia, about the neurobiology of the brain and its connection to music. It is fascinating stuff. Or I could talk about the famous saliva studies, where researchers have taken saliva samples from singers before, during, and after performances, and found that after performing, their levels of immunoglobulin A and cortisol were noticeably higher, indicating enhanced immunity. But those might be more appropriate to next year when we have a From the Head series. This is supposed to be From the Heart. Music has always been a spiritual refuge for me. Not quite a religion per se, but certainly one of my very basic needs. This summer, when Jamie and I snuck out one morning to go to the bakery in a borrowed car, we got to the parking lot and heard a performance of Bach's motet, Singet dem Herrn, on the radio. I begged him not to shut off the car, and I sat sobbing in the car. When the piece finished, it was a really good performance. He looked at me, kind of questioningly, and I replied that I find it very difficult to exist in the summer without the ability to make music. I feel hollow and vacant. Music has become such an integral part of who I am as a person. It keeps me in touch with myself and how I relate to the world. I am blessed to spend hours each day studying, preparing, conducting, and recreating music. And I do this, hopefully nurturing the next generation of budding musicians into believing that this is a worthwhile endeavor, because I truly believe that it makes our lives healthier in a spiritual sense. Because our world of competition and winning and materialism gets a little too out of control for me sometimes. I think we tend to lose sight of that which we truly need: kindness, beauty, and community. In making music, we gather together in a shared community to create, appreciate, and realize something that is beautiful, powerful, and far greater than the sum of its parts. Now, I know this sounds idealistic, and in rereading my words, I can shake my head with many of you at the simplicity and naivete of them. But last week, in her sermon, Jennifer said words that smacked me right upside the head. She said, "Remember, religious folks don't do things that make sense in this material commercial world. We don't take action just because it will lead to some sure outcome. We don't do things because we are sure that we will win. We do things because it makes a difference to our spiritual health and spiritual wholeness." Now, for me, if you substitute the word musicians for religious folks, then you get a glimpse into my how and why. And now, you want to know the best thing about music? It tends to speak for itself. So I can stop and let you hear for yourself what all this blather is really trying to express.